The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem, Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Well, good afternoon to you. Thank you for coming along for the Tuesday, March 19th edition of The Ride Home. Dare I say, quite excitedly, the first day of spring.
Woohoo!
Ah, yes.
It's also freezing.
It is. It's okay.
I had to pull, well, first of all, you're wearing a turtleneck.
I am.
And I had to go in search of my big scarf because I walked outside this morning and I thought, nope, I'm not prepared for this.
Yep.
So I went right back inside, had to dig for my scarf, put it on. I'm fine with it, but it's just, it's hard to go from the flip-flop to the,
to the boot.
Yeah, I'm wearing my big boots today.
I get you, yeah. Like I said, I'm wearing a turtleneck.
Cold. And look, I'm wearing my flannel.
Layers. It's going to change here, right? Because we had a taste of it the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. This whole week is going to be cold.
It's okay.
It's fine.
Opening day is not that far away. It's less than 10 days away for baseball.
Yeah. And let's hope that it's not snowing on that day because you've had a lot of snowy first days.
Right. But they're going to be in Miami for the, for the first
week. Yeah, but that's not the one you're going to.
No, it's not. So anyway, thanks for being with us.
Anyway, so it'll be a week later, you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, because they're not starting off here. Okay.
Right.
We'll give the calendar some time to kick in.
And spring doesn't kick in until this evening, I think 11:06 p.m.
Oh, so it's still winter.
Yeah.
So the reason why I have my scarf and my flannel on.
Plenty of time.
My boots.
Heck yeah.
Coming up on our 5 o'clock hour today, thousands of churches on the brink of closing down. What does it mean? Is it all bad news?
Now, well, of course, it's not great news.
Okay.
But what do the empty buildings mean?
Right.
And how will they be repurposed for the greater good?
Right.
We'll find out about that.
Okay. We'll talk about that in the 5 o'clock hour with Bob Smetana from Religion News Service. Also coming up in the 5 o'clock hour, an interesting thing that had a conversation that's been being had in Ireland about the roles for women.
Mothers.
Yeah. Whether working at home and being a mom is still something that's honored by society or not.
There was a vote about this.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that as well.
Yeah. So we'll talk about. Also, does this make sense in the 5 o'clock hour? Mm-hmm. And in the 4 o'clock hour, is there a Christian call to support Israel? We've been talking a lot about Israel and Hamas. So we'll talk about that. Also, some local news. It looks like the same guy caught for the second time with a loaded gun at the airport. I just don't know what to say after a certain point. I just don't.
And just pile it on. All right, all that and more on the ride home. But as we always do, we get underway with the top news stories of the day. Kath, give us the top 4 at 4.
For Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. Should I start with number 1, John?
Number 1.
Peter Navarro, who served as White House trade advisor to former President Trump, turned himself in at a federal prison in Miami today to begin serving a 4-month sentence for defying a congressional subpoena. His surrender came one day after Chief Justice John Roberts rejected his 11th-hour bid to remain free while he appeals his conviction for contempt. At a press conference at a strip mall across the street from the prison. Now, that's just a great sentence. Wait, can I say that again? At a press conference at a strip mall across the street from the prison, Navarro claimed his case represents an unprecedented assault on the separation of powers and executive privilege. He pledged to appeal his conviction up to the Supreme Court and claimed that this conviction stemmed from the actions of lawmakers who are Trump haters. Mm. There is no evidence to that regard at this point. He's the first former White House official to go to prison after being convicted of contempt of Congress. Navarro was charged and found guilty after he refused to comply with a subpoena from the House Select Committee that investigated the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Congressional investigators were seeking docs and testimony from the former White House official, which was tied to what the heck happened after the 2020 election. Read more about that at CBS News. Number two, medication abortion accounted for 63% of all abortions performed in the U.S. in 2023, according to a new study from the Guttmacher Institute. In the first full calendar year following the overturning of Roe v. Wade, approximately 642,000 medication abortions took place within the healthcare system. Since the court's decision, 14 states have ceased nearly all abortions. And this is really interesting. There was an estimated in this is 2023. There were an estimated 1,026,000 abortions in the formal U.S. healthcare system. And this represents a 10% increase in the number of abortions from 2020. The highest number and rate of abortions measured in the country in more than a decade. It's from ABC News. Number three. More than a million people who broker home buying and selling in America are perhaps reexamining their career. Last week, the National Association of Realtors settled legal claims that the real estate industry conspired to keep commissions artificially high. The settlement will likely change how much of a home sales price will actually find its way into the hands of a realtor. Realtors from the suburbs of Maryland to Minneapolis expressed shock that the model for buying and selling homes for the past three decades was just like that, upended. They say they're now trying to gauge just how disruptive to their livelihoods the ruling will be. Most fell into one of three camps, according to the Wall Street Journal. One, deny the business will change much, embrace new payment models in the hopes of staying profitable, or number three, find an entirely new line of work. And number four, after more than 100 years of selling ice cream, Ben & Jerry's owner has lost its taste for the business. And that is your top four.
What do you say? No more Cherry Garcia?
Well, no. So Unilever owns Ben & Jerry's.
Right. So Ben & Jerry used to be just Ben & Jerry.
Right. But then Unilever bought it.
Right.
But you know what else Unilever owns? Hmm. Breyers, Klondike.
Whoa.
Also Popsicle. Hmm. Talenti, which is a delicious gelato or sorbet. They own all of those. But they're saying that they want to put its ice cream division as a standalone, as a separate entity, and they also might sell it.
Wouldn't that be a nice division?
They've sold ice cream since they bought Walls. Is that something that you're familiar with? Is that like a Midwestern thing? W-A-L-L, apostrophe S. Mm. Walls in 1922. Oh, it's a brand that was started by a butcher shop in London as a way to offset weaker meat sales in the summer months.
I like it.
Anyway, last year, $8.6 billion in sales for the ice cream division.
Lovely.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But Ben & Jerry's has kind of turned into something of a thorn in the side of Unilever, apparently. It has an independent board, and its parent company has repeatedly butted heads in recent years with the parent company. So, like, the Ben & Jerry's board is fighting with the parent board. Mm-hmm. They filed a lawsuit after Unilever sold its business in Israel without consultation.
All right. So you make trouble, you're gone.
I guess that's what it is.
That's his life.
Yeah.
All right. Take a quick break. We do come back. We're going to talk about the after effects of abortion. Stay with us. You're listening to Pittsburgh's Christian Talk. It's The Ride Home. The radio station is 101.5 Word FM, WORD.
Just a few minutes ago, we were talking about the figures that have come out today about the rate of abortion in America. More abortions in 2023 than have happened in the last decade here in America. And I'm sure the reasons for that are complex. I think, John, I'm guessing that part of it is because abortion was in the news so much.
That what? It stirred the pot?
Yep.
And so people got, women became pregnant and they were like, well,
this is my right. This is, I'm a woman and I should exercise my right.
What'd you say? First, the highest numbers in a decade?
In a decade. Yeah. In my experience, however, the political realm of abortion is just, it's just one tiny fraction of the actual story. Because abortion is, everything related to childbearing is so incredibly personal. And for every woman I talked to in a counseling room over many years, the number one thing women wanted was to be able to go back to just not being pregnant. And the hardest thing when you're in an unexpected pregnancy is to come to grips with the fact that there's no going back. That if you decide to carry the baby to term, you're never going to be the same. But here's the thing that a lot of people don't believe. If you have an abortion, you're never going to be the same too. And abortion is sold in our country as just some kind of panacea. It's just a medication thing. That's no big deal.
It's going to
like,
the
you're right. It's a, you know, exercise your right as a woman. It's no big deal. It's the best thing for you anyway. Well, we've invited Pam Irizarry to the program today to talk about some of the after effects of abortion, which is something that this country seems to be allergic to talking about. Pam is the executive director for Deeper Still Pittsburgh, and we're going to talk more about that organization in a bit. Pam, welcome in.
Hello. Nice to be here.
So, Pam, you heard my my statement before you came on the show with us. Do you agree with me that if you listen to the politics or the media in America, that there are no after effects of abortion at all?
No, I don't agree with that.
Oh, you feel like people do talk about that?
Well, I believe that. I'm sorry. Say that again.
I'm saying that if you listen to the media and the current conversation in America, it makes it seem like there are no after effects of abortion.
There are after effects of abortion. Absolutely.
So your experience in meeting with women and the conversation you've had, can you talk about what some of those after effects are, what you've seen and heard?
Yes. I have personally met with already hundreds of women who have had abortions, and what they are experiencing is, first, they experience a lot of regret. They experience a lot of shame, and they experience a lot of guilt, and it becomes the greatest secret that they just bury inside of them, and they'll carry it for sometimes decades because they don't want to bring it up. It's such a shameful thing for them. Mm-hmm.
And of course, men are part of this as well, aren't they?
Yes, they are. We also have many men who have come to our ministry with regret and with shame also.
So, Pam, talk to us about Deeper Still Pittsburgh. What does it look like? How do people find you? What is the, you know, what is offered in a process?
So Deeper Still Pittsburgh is a post-abortion ministry, and we provide a lot of hope and healing and restoration to women and men who've experienced the heartache, emotional heartache, and spiritual heartache from the after effects of past abortion with a lot of regret. Typically, people find us through churches or word of mouth, but we also have a website that they can find us. People will sometimes Google abortion recovery ministry, and they will find our national website, which is deeperstill.org, and they'll find Pittsburgh. And when they contact us, we offer free weekend retreats that they're 3 days. They are cost-free to the participants. And we take them through like building blocks of foundational understanding of we're faith-based. So what we do is we walk them through the building block foundation from the Word of God with a personal one-on-one ministry team.
Do you find women are surprised that they're experiencing difficulties after abortion?
No, actually, no.
Yeah. So did they, when they had the abortion, were they thinking that it would be okay and then they realized it wasn't? Or was it just they accepted the fact that it was going to be difficult and they went through with the abortion anyway?
I think that many times women will find themselves in a situation where they don't think that there's any way out. And they begin to think they have a lot of fear, and they don't have, they feel like they don't have any options. Many times they feel like the father of the baby doesn't want the baby, or they're not going to support them. Many times the participant or the woman is very young, and she has her whole career ahead of her. And if she's in the middle of college, or she's at a place that she doesn't want to tell her parents, and she has no financial support, they just panic, and they don't know what to do. So they feel like they're doing the best possible option for themselves. And we've had a couple women that will tell us that once they're in the abortion clinic, they've had their stories where the technicians or the nurses in the abortion clinic will tell them, don't worry, it'll just lay still. It'll be over in a few minutes. You'll never have to think about this for the rest of your life. And what we've found is that women will think about this for the rest of their lives. They never forget about it. Once that decision is made, the regret, the guilt, the shame, it immediately starts to just flood them. And for many, guilt is what they've done, but shame then is who they become. Mm-hmm. And they wear that shame for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. And Pam, that's what I was talking about when we started our conversation, that I feel like it's really unfair to women, because if you listen to anything in the media, they're telling you that if you just have an abortion, it'll be a few minutes, but after that, you'll never think about it again. And it's just not true. And so, you know, since John and I are immersed in news every day, that's all you ever read, is that if you choose to have an abortion as a woman, it's your right. You should be able to exercise it, do whatever you want. You'll be happier. You'll have more freedom. You won't have to be encumbered by a kid. You know, you won't have to, you know, do what this man wants you to do or whatever it is. And I just feel like at the end, it's the women who pay for that choice.
It's true. I believe that, you know, I'll put innate qualities in women, and part of that is nurturing. We're caregivers, we're lovers, we were made to be life givers. It's just part of our nature, who we are. And so to have an abortion goes against everything that God has created us to be as women. And God called Eve woman. He called her mother before she was ever a mother. And so it's just an innate quality that God gave to us. So when we have an abortion, it just goes against everything that we were made to be. And yes, we experience that pain for the rest of our lives.
We're talking.
And therefore, years ago, we were hearing a lot about the Hollywood actresses, you know, let's shout our abortion. And it just amazed me, because I think they've pushed it down so far. They're in denial. I think the enemy has just created this whole realm of deception around what abortion really is. But truly, abortion is very painful. It's traumatic. It's grief. It's something that you carry for the rest of your life.
Pam Irizarry is with us. She's executive director for Deeper Still Pittsburgh. So, Pam, talk about the 3 days, the workshops where women get together, or men. 3 days, I'm sure it's focused on grief and healing and forgiveness. Go into this, please.
Yes. We start with the foundation of the Word of God, and we start teaching about how God is just this, he's a merciful and a forgiving, compassionate God who loves them and just longs to set them free. And we take a look at the root of the foundation of what occurred prior to the abortion. It's almost like we walk them backwards. So what are the steps that led them to that abortion? And many times we find that there are father wounds, mother wounds, there are violations, there's incest, there's addictions, there's so many things that lead up to an abortion. So once we deal with the root foundation of the issue, we begin to break strongholds and soul ties that have kept them bound for many years. We help them break off old patterns, and then we give them hope for restored lives.
All right.
And then we give them And we give them space to grieve and to reconcile the loss of their children. And this is really important because society tells us that it's not a baby. They weren't allowed to grieve. And we allow them to grieve and let them allow them to see that, yes, it was a baby. You were lied to. And you do have a right to grieve that child mm-hmm. that you lost.
Yeah. Amen. Yeah. Well, this has been a really interesting conversation, Pam. Thank you so much. I'm looking at your website, Deeper Still Pittsburgh, and that's Pittsburgh spelled out, deeperstillpittsburgh.org. All the information I think you would want is on that website. And Pam, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure's ours. We'll take a quick break and reset. We're going to talk about Dante's Inferno, which is now a new PBS documentary. That's straight ahead. It's The Ride Home. In 1321, the leading citizens of Ravenna, Italy, carried Dante's body to his grave far from his native Florence, from which he had been exiled for years. Left behind was one of the modern world's wonders, the Divine Comedy, which was completed shortly before Dante's death and a spur to readers from his time to now. There's a new documentary that is airing this evening on PBS, Part 2. Part 1 aired last night. Rick Burns' new two-part documentary on the poem is beautifully executed, according to the Wall Street Journal, and collaborative in spirit. It's called Dante, Inferno to Paradise, appeals to lovers of art and anyone wondering what all the fuss is about with Dante. It features a winning combination of live acting, sweeping camera shots, and vivid artistic imagery. Rick Burns' documentary leads viewers through the three parts of the Divine Comedy. And it airs this evening, I believe, at 8 o'clock on all PBS stations, which would be ours, WQED. When the film ends, viewers may be moved to make Dante's journey for themselves, and those who do will discover the full glorious humanism of this son of hope and son of grace, as he is called in Paradiso.
Hmm.
Any interest?
I will watch it tonight.
Yeah, part two.
I'm hoping that maybe I could be able to get part one. Maybe they'll replay it over the weekend or something.
I bet you they will.
Yeah.
Right? We give a little bit of money to PBS.
Yeah. I have the app.
So there you go. That's what we
great.
Have. The app.
I
so you can go
right.
back and watch part
yes.
one tonight.
Okay, great. And then watch part two. Mm-hmm. That would be great. Will you watch it?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, me too.
Have you read the entirety?
Not the whole. Uh-uh. I've only read Inferno. I never read the Divine Comedy, the whole thing.
It's a hard read.
Yeah.
It's a slow read.
Right.
Isn't it? But beautiful.
And it's really helpful if someone walks you through it.
Yes.
Unless you're well-versed in being able to read, you know, ancient literature.
Right. So maybe this will spur us along. Right. Dante's Inferno, essentially, I mean, I was sold it as, you know, sort of a means of wading through a midlife crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Right.
I don't know if that's true or not.
You know what book I highly recommend is How Dante Can Save Your Life by Rod Dreher.
Yes.
It's a really good book.
Fascinating.
It's a very interesting book.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to have read Dante to appreciate the book.
But this documentary?
I think I'm going to watch it.
Yeah. Dante Inferno to Paradise this evening.
Listen.
Check local listings.
I got to tell you, last night my husband and I finished Masters of the Air.
Oh,
the Spielberg production on Apple TV. You have to watch this.
Really?
I mean, I got chills just thinking about
kidding.
It is so moving. So excellent.
I mean,
Every American should watch this. We don't have a fraction of what those men had.
No way. Those boys.
They were kids, and they were incredible.
I mean, I'm sure they talk about this in the series. What percentage of those guys who were in those planes were killed?
Well, that's why they decided to make this show, because they call it the Bloody Hundreds.
Yeah.
They lost so many
right.
out of this particular squadron.
I mean, they were essentially flying coffins.
They were
just wide
yep.
open to just
yep.
being crushed, shot down out of the air. And how about those guys in the ball gunner turret? I mean, just hanging there in a little piece of glass with a machine gun between your legs. Boom. Holy smokes.
I mean, I can't. And they, you know how My husband and I were talking about it. What Spielberg and Hanks have done with that portion of their career by doing Band of Brothers, by doing Saving Private Ryan, The Pacific, doing this.
It's a touchstone.
They have made such a difference in my personal worldview.
Yeah.
And I just didn't know any of that. I just didn't know that story.
And especially, you know, moving forward, 50 years from now, those stories will be told.
Exactly,
but
right.
We are still connected emotionally, physically in many ways, to the greatest generation who fought those battles and won the war.
Yeah.
So who better to tell that story than those two?
Really, I could not recommend it more highly.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Masters of the Air on Apple.
We'll take a quick break, and we are going to talk about, is there a Christian call to support Israel? That's next on The Ride Home.
Since October 7th, we have had many, many conversations about the conflict between Israel and Hamas. We were uniformly shocked. I think the world was shocked after the initial attack.
The horror.
So now, of course, things have broken down into partisan lines, political lines. I think that we've tried on our show to keep the humanitarian angle at the forefront of our minds. But it's not like we're non-political people. I mean, you know, politics is part of life. I don't want it to be the only thing in life, but it is a part of life.
We support Israel.
Right. We support Israel. We've invited people who have different perspectives to come and talk to us about this in hopes that we all might have a broader understanding of the conflict. And so we're really happy to have Jan Markell here today. She's the founder and director of Olive Tree Ministries, which we'll talk about in just a little bit. Jan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John and Kathy. Appreciate it.
Yes, the pleasure's ours. So, Jan, I guess the question of the day is there a Christian call to support Israel?
Well, the Bible says there is. The Bible, I think it's one of the few times there's a command, pray for the peace of Jerusalem, Psalm 122, followed by a promise, you know, they will prosper who love thee. Let's just look at it from even a practical standpoint. I mean, Israel is America's, if we want to focus on our country, America's number one ally, certainly in the Middle East and probably even in the world, top five anyway. First of all, our Lord and Savior came from that part of the world, so I think it's kind of sacred land, and quite frankly, I think he's coming back to that land probably sooner than we can imagine. So I believe that the Christian has an obligation to at least have a concern, be praying for the situation in the Middle East. And my concern, John and Kathy, is that this thing could spread even further than it looks like it's in the process of spreading now, and even could bring Iran directly into the conflict.
Yeah. You know, I don't like the conversation that we in America have about this right now. Of course, I don't like the conversation we have about anything, it would seem. But it just seems as if we've broken down into two sides. And one side is pro-Israel and they can do nothing wrong. And one side is pro-Gaza and Israel can do nothing right. And I just, first of all, nothing in the world is that simplistic. But it's shocking to me still that we can't all unify around what happened on October 7th and say that was an act of terror. It was an outrage against women in particular. But it was a terrorist act. I guess it's hard for me to believe that there isn't unanimous outrage about it.
And, you know, I think, Kathy, that's probably I would say that's the one thing that has shocked me more than I ever thought I could be shocked. And what I mean by that is, since that day, I mean, let's keep in mind that barbarians struck southern Israel. Their intent, by the way, was to keep going as far as Jerusalem and even into the West Bank and just keep doing what they did in southern Israel. And obviously God didn't allow that to happen. But what I never thought I would see in my lifetime is I'm seeing the world sort of cheer for these barbarians. And by that, I mean, you have pro-Hamas demonstrations, pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Some of them are blatantly pro-Hamas demonstrations all around the world. I never thought I could ever see anything quite like that. And that's not to suggest that every Palestinian is a barbarian, but these people are cheering the very people who planned and perpetrated and carried out this unspeakable attack back on October 7th, 2023. So why is the world not cheering, in fact, for one moment, please. Not cheering, in fact, for in supporting and even spiritually on the side of the Jewish people. They were the victim. They did nothing wrong. And I'm one of the first to say that Israel's not a perfect nation, because that doesn't exist until Jesus rules on this earth. But nonetheless, cheering for the barbarians has blown my mind in the last 5 months.
I agree, Jan. Jan Markell is with us. She's the director of Olive Tree Ministries, the founder as well. You can find it online, olivetreeviews.org. Jan, what's amazing to me is when you would look at a map of the Arab world, there's a tiny dot in the midst of it all, and that is Israel.
Yeah.
So on all sides, deeply, Israel is surrounded by its enemies who want nothing more than the complete and total destruction of Israel. And so what happened on October 7th is an exclamation point in that.
Right.
And I think
right.
people don't understand that, right? That they people want to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. And of course, as believers, we have a deep call to protect Israel. And there's the problem, right? I mean, the other thing I think on the flip side is this. It's the important thing to think about what's happening right now, you know, with the Palestinians. And of course, children, old people, all those people who are dying now and, of course, starving to death, that has to be taken into consideration as well. There's two sides of the coin here. It just can't be either or. Yeah?
Absolutely. And anybody, obviously, with a humanitarian heart is concerned about what's going on. I think what's kind of thrown a lot of people since October 7th is we hear so much about the innocent Gazans, the innocent Palestinians, and believe me, there are plenty who are innocent, particularly those who are much younger. We need to keep in mind, John, that the Gazans voted for Hamas some 15 years ago now to be an authority over them. And when you poll them, I'm told, and I'm not there, of course, but I'm told that if you poll them, many of them will still vote to reinstate Hamas as the authoritarians in Gaza. Now, I think that's hard for Westerners to wrap their brain around, and I think what we need to understand is there's a different mentality in that part of the world. It's not a Western mentality, and for some reason, and I would attribute it to the education that young Palestinians, and that would include those in Gaza, are getting from like age 2, 3 on, and that is hate Israel, hate Israel. Well, that sinks into the innermost being eventually, and they grow up, all they can think of is hating Israel. You know, and here's what I think the solution. The solution is probably only one solution, and that's a spiritual solution to this problem. That would be a number of these. If this community could come to faith, and by the way, there are Palestinian Christians for sure.
Oh, it's such a difficult issue, Jan. I was thinking of a conversation I had with a friend of mine last week, and he was saying that he feels like he can't criticize anything about the Netanyahu war plan or anything about Netanyahu's politics without someone calling him anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
And I get that. How do you see that? What would your response be?
Well, again, and I have said once in our short conversation that Israel is not a perfect nation. She's a secular nation. My goodness, she was founded with socialist principles almost 76 years ago. She has gone on through those decades to remain a fairly leftist nation. If I could just insert one comment about that, and that is the kibbutzim in the south were primarily, I'll use a term that some of your audience knows well, they're primarily a bunch of peaceniks. Mm. They were there because they wanted to be reaching and helping the Gazans. They employed the Gazans. They took them to their appointments in Israel, medical, et cetera. They did not have the imagination to know that those Gazans could do what happened. And as a result, because they've had such an eye-opening experience back on October the 7th, those leftist peaceniks have moved over to the center, even center-right. No, so how is that going to affect future elections? Mm. Personally, I did not think Benjamin Netanyahu would survive this crisis. it's looking more and more like he may, and I mean politically, that he may survive this. And if he does, number one, I think that's an act of God. But secondly, I think it's because the country, Kathy, has had a wake-up call. They realize that this leftism doesn't work. Now, here's the next step we want to see, is that they become more open to the gospel. And I work closely with agencies delivering the gospel to the Jewish people in Israel, and they are more open as a result of October the 7th. I'm not saying they're becoming a Christian nation, but they're more open to the gospel. That's a start.
Yes. I mean, when you look at what's happening right now, Jan, I mean, it's hard to think that Israel is going to let up, despite worldwide claims for them to back off. I mean,
why should they back off? I mean, I'm not saying that they should not respond to calls for humanitarian treatment of civilians,
which is happening.
But until Hamas surrenders, why should they back off?
Well, it's interesting to see the news today that Hamas is back in that hospital, which, you know, underground, the 600 plus miles of tunnels. You know, as soon as they walk away, then Hamas, you know, just comes back in again. They're like just like a rat in a maze. And so you think, I mean, Israel's goal is to eradicate Hamas.
Right.
That's a tall order, isn't it, Jan?
It's a tall order, and they've done an incredible job, by the way. But look at the collateral damage that's happened in the process. All of this could have been avoided. This did not have to happen. But again, when you've got these little 3 and 4 and 5 year olds being indoctrinated, as soon as they can understand language to hate, this is what happens. It's what happens to an unregenerated society, and it's what happens in the midst of Islam. So can you imagine being surrounded? And you outlined it well, but if we had a map and we could show a map, we would see the vast empire of Islam that surrounds a nation the size of New Jersey. They have no choice but to push back with force. They know as of October 7th, giving peace a chance is not going to work. It will never work in the future. Benjamin Netanyahu says, we're pressing on. We will eliminate the... Now, here's the... Gentlemen, John and Kathy, here's the thing. It's not done in Gaza. For them, they're going to go for Hezbollah. And then, as I said in my opening, are they going to have to go all the way to Iran? I think so. I think that could happen here in 2024. And I think they may take advantage of the fact that there's really... You look on the world, who's a world leader right now? We lack a world leader. And the bad guys of the world are taking advantage of the fact that we lack a world leader anywhere, Europe, anywhere.
I'm into that. Pray for peace. Pray for Israel. Jan, before you leave us, take a moment and talk to us about Olive Tree Ministries.
Well, we joined your radio lineup, I think, about a year and a half ago, and we love hearing from Pittsburgh folks. We are a ministry that was formed some 30 years ago. We try to help people understand the times, contend for the faith, be watchmen on the wall to better understand the times, and we are staunch supporters, and I would say try to communicate effectively the fact that Jesus is coming back sooner rather than later, and be ready, folks. And that means have your heart ready, having Jesus Christ, Lord and Savior of your life. And that's kind of what we're doing right now on about 1,000 radio stations, and we appreciate anybody listening from your station, John.
Fabulous. Jan, thank you for your passion, for your advocacy, for your great care for Israel.
Thank you now. Goodbye.
That's Jan Markell. You can find out more at olivetreeviews.org. That's olivetreeviews.org.
A game-worn Roberto Clemente jersey from the Pittsburgh Pirates 1960 World Series sold recently for $256,000 at a Leland auction. Of course, during that season, Roberto batted .314, 94 RBIs, as the Pirates boasted a 95-59 record.
Wow, 95-59 record.
On the way to the World Series win, the jersey features a gray vest-style button front top that received a grade of excellent from SGC, the second highest grade attainable, according to a Leland's press release. The Pirates, of course, would go on to beat the heavily favored New York Yankees. It doesn't say...
Does it have a picture? Can I see it?
Yeah. Doesn't say who owned the jersey.
Mm-hmm.
and how long they've had possession of it. Because you imagine something like that, how precious that was.
Yeah.
How did that get off Roberto Clemente's back
right.
and into someone's hands who held on to it for a period of time to make a $250,000-plus profit?
In my opinion, it just looks so cool.
It's super cool.
It's so cool. So as John said, it's like the vest style. So it buttons up the front.
Yeah.
No sleeves. You'd wear it. Obviously, there'd be a shirt underneath it. But it just looks, it's the ultimate old school. It looks terrific.
I love it so much.
Oh, yeah. Man. And it doesn't say who bought it?
Nope. Doesn't say who okay. bought it. Doesn't say who sold it.
Mm-hmm. All right. In other news, John, speaking of local things, a Bethel Park man was caught for the second time with a loaded handgun in his carry-on at the airport. The man was stopped Friday with a .380 caliber handgun, and it was loaded with 6 bullets.
What the heck?
That's according to TSA. He didn't have a permit. And it's the second time the same guy was caught. The first time he was caught was back in 2014. This gun seizure brings the total number of firearms caught at the airport's checkpoints to 7 so far in the first 8 weeks of the year. So we're talking about at least one per week.
Well, there was a record set last year.
6,737.
Right? Nationally.
Yes, you're right. Nationally, yeah. Pittsburgh was part of that disturbing trend. Now, listen, when stopped by our officers, the man admitted up front that he had previously been caught with a gun in his carry-on several years ago.
Well, that alone should go make him think about before he packs for the airport.
What is he?
So he didn't have a permit either.
No, he didn't have a permit.
Some
and he says,
cannon.
Oh, well, I already got flagged for this. Well, okay.
Okay, so the fine for this can be as high as
$15,000. Depending on the weapon and the circumstances.
Right. So you would think if anyone's going to get a fine of $15,000.
It has to be this guy.
You would think, right? I don't know. Whatever. Okay. How about this? Speaking of local stories, the Hayes Eagles.
Yeah.
Sad news.
Oh, no.
After incubating a single egg for 29 days, Pittsburgh Hayes bald eagles both left the nest at 7 a.m. this morning after a live webcam revealed a broken egg, meaning that there will be no Hayes chick this year. The Hayes eagles have been nesting on the same hillside near the Glenwood Bridge for 11 years. The birds have successfully raised more than 20 eaglets to date. Pics cams of Murraysville and the Audubon Society have operated a live webcam on the nest for a decade. As nature is, quote, is very unpredictable, I'm reading from today's PG, it is heartbreaking to witness the collapse of the egg at the Hayes nest, said Bill Powers, the owner of Pics cam. Pics cams estimated that a Hayes egg would have hatched on March 26th.
Oh.
Bald eagle eggs typically hatch 35 days after they are laid. An Audubon Society spokesperson said the organization was sad to learn of the broken egg. Quote, an adult eagle was seen incubating the egg as recently as 7 a.m. this morning. But when the adult stood up, it appears that the adult quickly realized that the egg was no longer intact. Last year, the longtime male known as Dad went missing, and the female bonded with a new mate. The new couple produced one egg this season. The webcam's chat room is filled with posts this morning from watchers lamenting the loss of the egg and the end of the nesting season. There have been years where there have been 3 eaglets produced.
Yeah, right.
This year, 0.
Do birds have a sense like
of loss?
Yeah.
I wonder.
But they knew right away.
Yeah.
So 7 o'clock this morning, everything was okay?
Stood up.
And then?
Then shortly thereafter, by the description, one of the eagles stood up and said, oh, and then they both left the nest. Like, okay, we're done. So they had to know. But as far as, I mean, I can't, sentimentality or at least awareness of a loss. There, of course, there's the awareness of the loss because they left.
Right.
But. The feelings? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
That. I don't think that.
What about your animals that you live with? Do you ever notice that? Feelings?
No. Okay. I'm just trying to eat each other's food. There's loss when the food bowl's
empty. Well, I remember that we had the same 2 cats for 12 years. When one of them died, that was So definitely loss on behalf of the survivor,
yes,
right?
Right, yeah.
But not at this time. They don't care about each other while they're all alive. Not much.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Well, I think it's true that since January, February, and now March, all of us have seen the obvious, which is an early spring, which really is today. I mean, not only did Phil say early spring, right, but the season, you know, also begins a day early. Spring begins a day early this year because it's a leap year.
So today is the first day of spring?
Yes. The vernal equinox arrives this evening.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight at 11:06 p.m. Eastern Time, marking the end of winter and the first day of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. Usually the equinox falls on the 20th of the month, but of course, the aforementioned leap year, it is a day early.
Mm-hmm. Will you be celebrating at 11:08 or whatever you said, 11:06?
I'll probably be sleeping.
You okay?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
In my dreams, obviously. But I'm celebrating now.
Right? Yeah, by wearing your black turtleneck. And you're talking to me in my off-white flannel.
Yeah, but we've been spoiled. Seriously. Okay, so...
Well, I didn't ask to be spoiled.
Well,
I mean, I was wearing flip-flops because that's what the weather called for.
You don't ask to be spoiled ever?
Well,
ever?
No, you're right. That's a lie.
Yeah, right.
That's
exactly.
A lie.
Of course it is. I know you.
Good grief.
2 years ago, I bought six bags of salt. No, I bought seven bags of salt.
Each bag weighing?
50 pounds.
Wow. Okay.
Last winter, I used a half a bag. Like,
wow.
The worst, the least ever. This winter, I used a bag and a half.
Okay.
So I'm still up. I mean, I don't have to go to the salt guy.
Say for another couple of years at this rate.
I mean, he may have passed for all I know. I haven't seen the guy.
That's what he's probably saying about you. That guy who buys all the salt, he may have passed.
I'm still here, my friend. I am still here. Yeah. But I mean, that to me is like kind of the groundhog thing.
Right.
How much salt are you using? I've told you.
Right.
I mean, there have been years where I've used hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds of salt on that driveway.
We've had it cakey.
Oh, for years.
I mean, I'm teasing about the flannel because I feel like... Like, it's just winter here is a different animal than it was when I was a kid.
Oh.
When I was even, like, when in the, you remember the storm 1993, the March storm?
Oh, yeah, sure. Remember it well.
Oh, my gosh. Was that a mess?
I was living in Bloomfield, and I had a cat, and I remember shoveling, like, way out of my driveway, and the cat was, like, amazed. He kind of was, like, walking in the Grand Canyon.
Right.
Oh, la, 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 la. It was super cool.
That was a crazy, crazy storm.
It sure was. We may never see anything like
that.
We
may never. I'm telling you what. Anyway, so if today's the first day of spring, that means free stuff at Rita's. Am I right?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Every year on the first day of spring, which is today, Rita's gives a free 6 ounce.
Right.
Gelato or shaved ice or whatnot.
Okay. You going?
I can't. No, because I'm not doing sweets.
Me neither.
So.
Dang it.
Yeah. I mean, we just had a treat there during the top of the, I had a breath mint.
Did you? Yeah, me too.
Thinking, oh my God, I'm a little large there.
Yeah, this is really.
Holy smoke.
Okay. So Lexi Merritt, our producer. Lex, I'm going to ask you a question in a sec. So we've all been off sugar since the beginning of Lent.
Yeah.
I actually started a couple weeks earlier.
Did you though?
I did just because I was.
You're always a high achiever.
No, it's
you
not
know
why.
You're always
That's
trying.
That's not
to.
Why.
It's the truth.
Anyway, I am wondering if you all have noticed any difference. Like, wow, I can think more clearly. My joints hurt less. And do you have anything? Lexi, can I start with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So a while back, I did no sugar, like no sugary things. And then, you know, I'd substitute them for things that were sugar-free. Like, as you've probably noticed, I've been drinking zero sugar Dr. Pepper.
Yeah.
Because I'm, like, just trying to get that little fix. But what's really nice about not having any sugar is that I feel like I'm thinking a little clearer. And something that I noticed the last time I did this and this time is that I'm not craving anything like super sweet or super salty as much as I used to when I was eating
sugar.
Okay. So I'm not having the cravings that I used to have.
Oh, so it kind of leveled things out?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Do you fantasize about, you know, something sweet?
Well, I want to eat sweets, but I go, okay, well, if I want a cookie, then I'm going to make like... a sugar-free version, or
yeah, okay.
I'm going to make, like, something that has, you know, more fiber in it or more protein in it. And it's not just sugar. It's, you know, it's something that's actually going to be good for me.
Okay. What about you, John? Have you noticed anything?
I wish that I noticed some big, you know, sort of cataclysmic, like, oh, my, you know, my joints don't hurt.
Right. Or, I feel, you know, right. Everything's so...
pretty much the same for me.
Yeah, me
it really
too.
Is.
I haven't noticed anything.
One weird thing I've noticed is when I'm tempted, like, oh, I could, you know, like we had friends over the other night. And so it was kind of like a St. Patrick's Day. My wife made everything, all the hors d'oeuvres were green.
Oh, that's funny.
We had guacamole. And,
that's so funny.
And, you know, she bought some fun stuff, like, you know, those like little chewy spearmint leaves, you know, like those.
Oh, you mean those?
Mm-hmm.
Was that hard for you?
Oh, she bought a bag of those. And so they sat out all night long.
The spearmint ones.
Yes, which I love. I would be happy to eat those. Any like, wake me up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm ready to have one of those. So they've been in the kitchen cupboard there, you know, a few leftovers. So I open those things up, and I'm like, oh. And then weirdly, my mind will go, eat one of those. And then I'll go, no. And then I'll have an overriding this is just me, an overriding sense of shame and failure.
But you haven't given in.
But that to me is like, so like, I've been thinking, well, this is like a spiritual thing for you, John. You are denying yourself to draw closer to God. But actually, it's just a weird psychological thing. I'm filled with shame and failure.
But you shouldn't be, because you haven't done it.
I don't know. It's just a weird thing.
Yeah.
I count it all to my Catholic grade school upbringing.
Well,
I'm not quite sure what that is.
That could be. I had a friend who came over the weekend, and they mistakenly left a Ziploc bag of cookies.
Like contraband.
They're like oatmeal chocolate chip cookies, okay? In a Ziploc, need I remind you, is clear.
Yeah.
And so I was just looking at it.
Do not.
And the spearmint leaves thing, that wouldn't, you know, that would not tempt me.
Yeah, yeah.
But that, you kidding me?
That's my favorite.
Finally, I got home from work yesterday, and I was like, I have to put these in the freezer.
Yep.
Like, I can't even look at these.
Good.
I cannot even look at these. Mm-hmm. And last night, I dreamt about dessert. I did. You guys, I dreamt. It was I don't remember the details, but I laughed when I woke up because I thought, oh my gosh, I really lost it. Mm-hmm. I think I was in some sort of like patisserie, and I was just surrounded by all sorts.
Sweets.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like the cookies are like the devil's in the house. There it is.
Exactly.
I'm calling you out.
Someone poked a hole in the dike.
Heaven help us.
Yeah.
All things considered, though, this has been really good. I mean, I'm not saying I'm going to continue this.
Right.
But I like the tension in my life that it creates.
It is good for me to not get what I want.
Mm-hmm.
I keep telling myself that.
Yeah.
It is good for me.
To not get
especially
it. Especially
really in the place I live, I have so much freedom to get what I want.
Of course we can.
And it's just not, it's a really good experience to just say, no, I'm not doing that.
Right. The other day, or yesterday actually, my kid said, you got a gigantic box from Amazon. I was like,
what'd I get?
Well, I just forgot because I ordered a dog bed.
Oh.
But, you know, that's how much.
It's so easy.
You forget. I mean, I forgot that I ordered a dog bed.
Yeah, right.
What did you say?
It's just good for me not to get what I want.
It's just good for me to not get what I want.
We had a guest on the show a couple weeks ago talking about Sabbath.
Yeah.
I don't remember his name, but he was a really good conversation. And one of the things he said, John, that I remember is he was talking about the Sabbath. He said, you need a break from the world, and the world needs a break from you.
Amen to that.
Oh, gosh. Anyway, we need to take a break. But when we come back, we've all seen churches around the Pittsburgh area that have closed, or churches around the Pittsburgh area that are in the process of closing. What does it mean? And what happens to all those buildings? Looking forward to a conversation with Bob Smetana next. Stay with us. It's the Tuesday edition, The Ride Home. If any city has experienced churches that are were once vibrant and then kind of fell into a period of disrepair and then closed, we've seen that here in Pittsburgh over the last decade in spades.
Easily.
I mean, it's just shocking.
There's a church in my old neighborhood where I went to elementary school, right on the same street, a little tiny church that just went on the market for, I think, $300,000. And the listing is, please, someone use this, whether it's a house or a community center or whatnot. What do you do with these, sad to say, the abundance of churches that now sit empty and wanting.
Right. And does that mean that we are all empty and wanting? Spiritually? I don't know. But we've invited Bob Smetana back on the show to talk to us about that. Bob Smetana is from Religion News Service, and he wrote an article about this very thing. Bob, we're glad you're back.
Oh, glad to be here.
Thank you, Bob. So you had a conversation with an author of a book called Gone for Good, who looked at the way that churches could be reused for the public good in the future. Did you leave after that conversation feeling positive about these churches that now sit empty, or is there deeper undercurrents of, you know, sort of sadness or despair?
Well, that's a good question. I think there's probably a little bit of optimism and a little bit of pessimism. I mean, one reason we did this story, and I've been reporting a lot of this, is there's just going to be a lot of churches that are closing. Yeah. And the idea of this book was to get people to think about it ahead of time. So if your church is doing well or your church is in trouble, think about it before it's too late. Because often what happens is congregations wait till we have lots of congregations that are shrinking, and they know they aren't going to be able to stay open long term. But they don't think long term, and they avoid thinking about it.
Sure.
And if you avoid thinking about it, then all your choices are taken away.
Mm-hmm. So in the article, Bob, you say, the first sentence grabbed me. If experts were predicting that 100,000 libraries across the United States were likely to close in the next few decades, people would probably sit up and take notice. Certainly, if 100,000 school buildings were going to be empty in small and large communities, someone would be talking about it. But the possible demise of 100,000 churches, that itself is a reality, isn't it, Bob?
Yes. So that's an estimate of what could happen in the next couple decades. We know from a couple things. One is that the average congregation size has shrunk from about 130 people 20 years ago to 65. And that's the median size. So half the churches in the country are under 65 people, which isn't a lot of people, especially if you've got a large church building. And the number of people who identify as Christian is shrinking. The number of people who go to church is shrinking. So we have the editor of this book actually talked about it, compared it to Blockbuster Video. Hmm. You remember Blockbuster Video?
Sure.
It was huge. You went to the store, and then all of a sudden you didn't have to go to the store to get those videos, and they closed in mass numbers because you didn't need the space anymore. So this is there are going to be tens of thousands of churches that are closed. And one thing we forget about is that they are free. They're basically free public space. So if you think about all the things that might happen at church, you might have concerts, you might have classes, you might have neighborhood association meetings, you're going to have AA meetings, you're going to have food pantries. So even if a church doesn't have very many people, chances are their building does a lot of good for their neighborhood. And it's a free, in often cases, a free public space.
Right.
And if you close, and they're in a neighborhood. So if you close those churches down, then that space is gone forever.
Bob, before we talk about perhaps the repurposing of church buildings, I want to go back to the Blockbuster analogy and ask what the writer of this book, or what you how far you think that analogy holds. So with the Blockbuster thing, Blockbuster, obviously that was a much faster decline because those brick and mortar spaces just weren't needed anymore because people could stream at home. Are you saying, or is he saying, that the reason that church buildings are closing is because people are getting their quote-unquote church online?
Well, there's two things. People are getting their churches in alternate ways, right? They're getting their spiritual. So people are interested in spirituality, but they're not interested in maybe joining a church. So that's one of them, I think, just the general way. So there's the particular thing of that the way people think about connecting to God and religion, you know, has changed. We have this whole idea that you can be spiritual but not religious. Mm-hmm. And then there are other kind of, that's part of a major social change, that people don't join associations or clubs anymore, that they do a lot of things online, that they don't trust institutions anymore. And then we just have the problem of demographics, especially for congregations that are mostly white, who have fewer of their kids come into church. So there's this great, it's kind of a great line. It's a little bit funny. It's a little bit sad. But, you know, there's two reasons why people don't go to church right now. The two major reasons. One is they move, they can't find a new church. The other one is they die. So there's a sociologist who says, if you ask them, why don't people go to church? She'll say, because they're dead. Hmm. And it's a way of saying that as older church members die off and pass on, there aren't young people to replace them. And that's a demographic math problem. Right. Right? There's a Pew Research has a line in the study. They just looked at people leaving churches and people dying off, and said there's no math that shows a revival of Christianity in America. It doesn't mean it'll shrink, but it means that it doesn't mean it'll disappear, but that it will shrink. And the buildings that we once had to serve certain kinds of needs are not needed anymore.
Yeah. Bob, my wife and I, one of our little favorite places to go to, you know, we grab a quick sandwich or something. It's a place in our neighborhood. And the weird thing is, it used to be a Pizza Hut. And now, of course, when you look at the building.
Right. It looks like a Pizza Hut. They all look like Pizza Huts.
Exactly. I mean, the Pizza Hut architecture, they're all over the country. I mean,
what about the red plastic glasses? Do they still have those inside?
No, they don't sell. But we laugh every time we go in. We go, we're going to Pizza Hut, but we're not. But, you know, it's the same thing in some ways. I don't want to minimize it.
Yeah.
As a church, you see the church. You know the intended purpose for the church. For those of us who are believers, there is something that's deeply sacred and holy. So, again, in another neighborhood we used to live in, there was a church, a large church, that went under, and it turned into a restaurant. And one day, against my better thoughts, we went in there and sat down and had a meal. It was the worst meal. It was deeply uncomfortable for me to sit there on the altar and have a sandwich. And I thought, all the people who were married there, had baptisms there, the confessions there, communion was there, and here I am eating a chicken parm sandwich. It was totally, I just hated it so much, I would never go back. But that's what's going to happen. I mean, better that the churches are being used, but we see holiness in brick and mortar, don't we?
Yeah. So I think the one thing that, so there's been this pushback to say, because church buildings can be, people can spend a lot of money and time on the church building, there can be this idea that the church is not the building, it's the people, which is true. But that's a little bit like saying a family is not your house.
Right.
Yes, and your home is not your house. But if you don't have a house to live in, then you are, you know, it's not a great thing. And so that's the kind of thing. Yeah, I think there's and one of the things that this book is trying to get at is to say, if this is going to happen, right, if you know that you're, then think about how could your church be preserved. There are churches who do things like they'll basically turn the church into a shared space. So they'll still worship there, but they will they won't consider themselves. They'll be like the main tenant in a building, but other people can use the space. And that way more folks can use it. They will find a school that needs this or another nonprofit. They will think of all kinds of, sometimes they get turned into affordable housing. Sometimes they get turned to, like I said, shared space. Sometimes there's another nonprofit. So this is great. Church I know in St. Louis where they knew their building, they couldn't afford the building anymore. So they sold the building to a school. School still meets there. It still has a charitable purpose. They took the money, they started a coffee shop and invested in a local Christian person who wanted a coffee shop. But it's not a Christian coffee shop, but it's a coffee shop that's like a third space in their neighborhood. And they may not own it forever, but they thought, let's be proactive. The whole idea of this book and this whole conversation is to be proactive, to say, what's going to happen to this building? Because if you aren't proactive, then what happens is, it gets too late, and the later it gets, the fewer options you have.
Right. And the more an old building declines, the more expensive it is, right, to get it back to some usable space. Yeah, we see that a lot in Pittsburgh, Bob, because Pittsburgh is such an old city, and a lot of our churches are, you know, 19th century churches. Mm-hmm. And when they get beyond a certain point, as tragic as it is, there's no going back. But like John was saying about having his chicken parm on the altar, on the former altar, I like these ideas about, you know, bringing in a nonprofit. You mentioned a rural church that's opening their doors to make it a healthcare clinic, community health. I like all those. But at the same time, it makes me really sad. I mean, when I think about the primacy that those churches had in those, in these communities in Pittsburgh, I mean, I guess I just have to accept the fact that that era is over.
Yeah. No, it's hard because it's like losing your family home. Mm-hmm. Right. So actually I wrote about a church a couple of years ago that I used to attend, and I went to their last service, and it's a little more of an op-ed piece. There's an important piece, but I said, you know, I used to go to this church. But they sold it, and they I thought they were going to sell it to another church. And I thought, well, okay, that's all right. But then they sold it to a group that's not going to use the church, and they kind of tore everything out. And then I saw those pictures, and I thought, oh, this is terrible. And I was like, not that that other group was bad, but it was the way the loss became real. So there's real grief and loss, which is why we don't talk about things, right? We don't talk about things that are hard. We don't want to talk about. So it's understandable. It's just that these are they're part of this new world we're going to be in. And you can ignore the new world. You can kind of rage against it, or you can say, how do we adapt to this? And it doesn't mean that a churches will be gone forever. But, you know, as you said, if a church's building is too big and the maintenance goes fast, it's easy to wait too long.
Yeah.
And then it's, you know, and then what is a beautiful thing is lost.
Yep. Gone forever. I mean, not that long ago, a couple of months ago, there was a long protracted fight against a church here in the city. And the historic people said, this is a historic building. You can't tear it down. And so it wound its way through the courts till finally it reached a dead end. And then one day, literally, the bulldozers showed up and they knocked that thing down. I mean, and it was horrible to see. You know, you look at that and you think, ugh, it's like someone's dying. It takes on physical ramifications. It hurt my heart to see it. I had to turn away. I don't want to watch it.
Yeah. No, it's hard. It's like anything, right? Any of these kinds of changes are ends of eras. There are, but it doesn't have to be that way. The other issue is for congregations or churches that have hierarchy, mm-hmm. so that the church doesn't belong to the congregation, that those churches can sometimes wait long. They sell it for the highest dollar to kind of to keep the broader mission going. Or they wait for a long time, and then there's not a kind of nimbleness to it to say. And, you know, we're also talking about, like, church denominational headquarters, church camps, church regional buildings. There's just a lot of property out there, you know, probably billions of dollars of property that could be thought of, that does serve the public good. I think, you know, the other part of this is that a church one of the things that Mark Elston, who edited this book, talks about is that this is a case where churches have to reengage their neighborhood. Ask, mm-hmm. what does their neighborhood need? Ask, are there other people who want to meet there? Maybe let another church meet there. Maybe in the South sometimes, where you have a little more, often you have more Baptists or congregation-owned property, sometimes a new church will come along and they'll say, here, take our building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
An old church will say that. So there are all these kinds of thinking, oh, wait, this building is important. You're a steward of it. What's going to be here in 50 years? And say, well, who else could we partner with? Who else? What are other things could happen there to preserve this? And sometimes buildings can't be saved. They are too big.
Right.
But a lot of times they could be if people think about it ahead of time. But if you wait till the roof's caving in, like in Connecticut, there was a story about the roof caving in a historic church. It's a terribly sad story because, but it happened because they just waited too long.
Yeah. Bob Smetana is with us from RNS, Religion News Service. Bob, we're up against a break. Can you hang with us for a couple minutes?
Sure, yeah.
Terrific. We'll be back. Conversation about churches, what to do with the building, but not just that. If churches are closing, then religion's influence, as we know, it's just a physical description of how religion's influence is waning.
Does it matter?
Does it matter? Talk about that next on The Ride Home.
Years ago, when I was in elementary or junior high school or high school, it was common in my hometown to see members of the clergy walk through the streets. I mean, some were wearing their cassocks. Others were just walking around in street clothes. But everybody knew who those guys were. And whenever you saw them, I mean, at least me, you kind of straightened up a little bit. You kind of like, you know, mm-hmm. got a little tighter, or you wanted to present a little better than you normally would for just, you know, the average guy. And to me, when I think about that, that was the power, whether it was right or not, about the influence of religion in my life and in my hometown. Now, we all know this, right? We just talked to Bob about this, Bob Smantana about this, about the declining churches, right? And what do we do with empty church buildings? So what about the waning influence of religion in all of our lives? Some people say, oh, thank goodness. I'm happy that that should be gone from the public sphere. Others, like myself, I'll raise my hand here. I think the less engagement we have religion, the poorer society we are. Bob, you wrote a piece about this at Religion News Service that the polls say that most Americans think the religion influence is waning. Half say that's bad. It's an interesting piece.
Yeah, Bob.
Yeah,
wait. This is actually by Jack Jenkins. Who's one of your colleagues. But this is Pew data that came out Friday saying that 80% of adults say religion's role in American life is shrinking, as high as it's ever been in Pew surveys. But 49% say that religion losing its influence is a bad thing.
Yeah. If you want a nutshell about how people feel about American religion, that's it. Right? Half of folks think it's bad. Half either don't care or they think it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
We have this real disconnect. So I would often tell my folks who live in different parts of the country, especially when I lived in Nashville, which is in the Bible Belt, that I lived in a different universe because religion there was really important and it was still public. And that the assumption among the folks who live there, most of them, is that religion would be really important. In fact, the synagogues in town were often packed because people went to synagogue because going to be part of a religious institution was what you did in Nashville. And but, you know, other parts of the country, it's not as important. And there's this real divide here.
Bob,
worth paying attention to.
Is it an age thing? Is it a generational thing? Older generations say yes, younger generations say meh?
There's some of that. I think it's also where you live and all kinds of other factors. And how you identify, if you're part of a religion or not, it's going to change. But if you have fewer and fewer people identifying religious, then that's a smaller number of people who are going to care if religion declines.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. So how does that fit in to our conversation about church buildings? I mean, clearly they're both they're linked. I do feel like the building conversation is less important of an issue than this issue, which I feel like is at the heart of it.
I think they're linked. So I would make I would say they're linked in. Can I say yes and? Yes,
of course.
And.
You can also say you totally. Bob, I want to give you the freedom to totally disagree with me if you want.
Well, I think the two are linked. I think that one reason people may not be concerned about what happens to church buildings is they don't think it matters, mm-hmm. right? It's shrinking. So what? So one thing I write a lot about is that, oh, no, these organized religion that our institutions matter and that we should probably pay more attention to them, that the decline of organized religion is problematic for all of us, I would argue,
yes.
Because it's like the decline of all of our institutions, right? If you have a bunch of people who live near each other and kind of are spiritual but don't ever talk to each other and they can't do anything together. So that's one of the concerns for the religious nuns right now. There's a growing number of them, people who are not religious, but they're not organized in any way because right. They have nothing in common. And church is, I think this is one of the transitions we're having is to have the church, as the country goes from people who are mostly religious and religious had a high impact in society. When you go to transform as we are, but by as a new generation arises, that is less religious and sees it less important, then there's going to have to be more conversation about why does this matter and how and what does it mean to be, you know, there's the saying about getting a seat at a table.
Yeah.
What happens if it's not your table anymore? What happens if the table is four or five people? Well, that's a lot harder and a different thing when you have mostly religious people and you bring in one non-religious person in, they're the kind of minority. But when you have equal numbers of people who are religious and not religious, well, they have to figure out how to get along.
Right.
And what do they have in common?
Hmm. Years ago, when we saw Notre Dame burning down, we were live on the air when this was happening, and we turned on, it was probably CNN, and you saw the flames shooting up from Notre Dame. I mean, you could have knocked me over with a feather.
Me too.
I was shocked, and I thought. This is the end of religion in Europe, is
right.
what it felt like.
This is kind of like, this is the physical representation of the death of religion.
Yeah. Now, at the same time, right, you know, that story I told about, you know, walking around my hometown and seeing, you know, the priests or, you know, the reverends or whatnot, and, you know, sort of sitting up straighter because of that. Now, people would see those same guys and go, some people would go, you're a fraud or you're a hater or you're someone outside of the realm, right? And I think that the social construct, the culture, has turned against the people who are religious. And, of course, we as believers, we've done a poor job of that, of representing ourselves in the public sphere, because, you know, we're always our own worst enemy. We shoot ourselves in the foot, which feeds the cultural and, you know, secular push against us as being irrelevant.
Yeah, and then you have this idea, when you lose, this word privilege gets thrown around a lot. Sometimes it's hard. But when you lose esteem or respect, then you have to work harder, right? If you – things that you used to get by – so what we have in America is religious groups used to get a lot by – people used to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
You want a tax exemption? Sure. You get a tax exemption because you're valuable. They would defer to them on all kinds of things. You want to have a priest come in and pray at our thing? We should have a priest come and pray at our – like my graduation at 2 or 3 – religious people. We had a rabbi, we had 2 priests, we had a priest, a rabbi, and a pastor come and speak. And our secular high school graduation, and they were all relatives of the people in the school. And no one cared. Now, you might not be able to do that because there are concerns about you have enough people in the group who are not religious. So that's the kind of, when you lose the deference, then you have to work harder. Mm-hmm. So it feels like, that's why sometimes people feel like they're kind of under persecution when it's also a loss of preference. The other part is because we're so siloed into our groups. So this is the weird part about American religion. If you go to church, for example, you go to a big church. So the average person, even though the average church has 65 people, the average church that someone goes to has 400. So if you go to church, you go to a big church, which is full of people who all believe, and often, especially now, people have sorted themselves so everyone in the church believes the same thing. They vote the same way. They're very homogeneous. So you can go to church and be filled and think, we all believe the same things, and there's 300,000 churches in the country. Every church wants to be like this. And then you go on the culture and you go, it's not that way. Not everybody's religious. Not everyone has these assumptions. And there's a disconnect that's disconcerting for people, and they have to figure out how that works. Mm-hmm. It's unsettling, as that report said.
But, okay, so yes, I can see that that's definitely unsettling.
Yeah.
The question is, to me next, the next question would be, but is that good for us as Christians? I mean, in my thinking, I've started to look at, you know, Christianity's waning influence as maybe a good thing for me as a Christian, but because it causes me to take my responsibility more seriously, and it tests my allegiance to Christ because it's harder than it used to be. Your thoughts on that, Bob?
It's going to be harder. It is definitely harder. I think the way I've often talked about it is, have you been to the airport and you go on a moving walkway?
Yeah.
You go on that walkway and you think, oh, I'm going really fast, right? When you first go on one of those, you're going really fast down the thing. And if you walk on it, you're really going fast. Yeah. So the culture used to be like that, right?
Sure.
It used to push or carry people along to churches and religion because that was, oh, this is what you did. So if you want to know what was right, you'd go to the church. Or if you wanted to be spiritual, you'd learn all kinds about church things and the culture, kind of the basis of Christianity, and it would bring you there. So now that has changed. In some ways, you're walking against the tide. So it's going to be harder. It's going to require much more intentional engagement to get. So you'll have to work as hard to get the same results, and that's a big shift. But that's what ends up happening is people either get mad at the culture or they think, we have done something wrong in our church. because it's not as easy. You know, we must have done something wrong. Instead of realizing that the circumstances have changed. And if you realize the circumstances have changed, I think that makes it easier to say we have to adapt to our changing environment rather than saying, who can we blame and whose fault it is that we don't have what we used to have? And that drives us in the culture right now. We're in a culture where people are polarized and they're looking for someone to blame. And so you can blame the last pastor, or you can blame, you know, whatever kind of theology is that you don't like, or you can blame, and people make mistakes and do bad things all the time. But what they miss is that these bigger cultural forces are at play.
Yeah.
And they require you to be more proactive and adapt.
Yeah. All right. Well,
that's
listen,
a good word, Bob.
Yeah, we haven't solved anything, but I think that I have a better grasp on what's happening, Bob. And we always love when you join us on the show. Thank you.
Very interesting, Bob.
That's great. Yeah. Well, if you want, I have a whole book about this.
Oh, wait, tell us.
Reorganized Religion. That was out last year. So it's out in paperback now. It kind of walks people through all the things happening and the changing culture and ways people are adapting.
Excellent.
Reorganized Religion.
Yep.
Reorganized Religion, Bob Smetana. Bob, we hear that in April you're coming to Pittsburgh. Is that right?
I am coming to Pittsburgh in April.
Excellent.
All right, we're going to take you out.
Yeah, we're going to meet.
Oh, that would be great. Let's do that.
Okay, good. Very nice.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thanks, Bob. Always a pleasure.
Take care. Great talk to you. Bye.
Okay, we'll take a quick break. Come back. The Daily Feature.
Does this make sense?
That's next.
Does this make sense?
Does what make sense?
Squash.
Squash.
I don't mean the sport.
Yeah.
You got your acorn. You got
spaghetti.
Your butternut. Your spaghetti. Does that make sense?
Well.
You got your yellow. Maybe zucchini. Zucchini's a squash.
Yep. My wife always has to talk me into it.
Yeah.
And then when I eat it, I go, that was good. But it's always like a, come on. You know, I cut these. They're in the oven right now, like a butternut squash.
But you're never excited about it when you hear that.
Not really. But then when she pulls it out and like there's some butter in there and maybe some, you know, nutmeg or whatnot.
Yeah.
I go, oh, yeah. However, I do have a problem with the spaghetti squash.
Oh, really? What's that?
I want spaghetti.
Right. It's not a pasta substitute.
No. It's sold as a pasta.
It is.
Put some red sauce on there. It's a pesto. It's always disappointing. But squash itself, once I get over the hump, yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Okay.
Does it make sense?
I don't know what's happened to me, but all of a sudden it just makes all the sense.
What?
Yeah. Like, I don't get it, but I find myself looking forward to a squash.
Really?
Like, I made acorn last night, and it was one of those things. I had too many leftovers, and I actually didn't eat it, so I'm going to eat it tonight, and I was a little sad.
That's a big hurdle.
I don't know what's happened. Hmm. And I've started to make those zucchini fries, you know.
Oh, yeah, sure.
They're delicious.
Really?
Okay. So I'm going to say yes and yes.
Yeah.
That all it's they're making all the sense. Even the spaghetti, I'm in.
Hmm. It makes sense, but there's a caveat with me.
Okay.
All right, does this make sense? A florist.
Mm. Everybody used to have a florist.
Every hometown had a florist. Now, you can go buy flowers at Trader Joe's, which are gorgeous, right? I mean, Whole Foods, fairly inexpensive. A florist.
Yes, a florist makes sense. You know why?
Why?
Because they know what they're doing.
They sure do.
I mean, we can all be amateurs, and we can, like, you know, put a few flowers together. But don't you value someone who actually knows what the flower is, who knows where to get it, and can put it together and send it to a loved one for you? I feel like the florist has it, and a lot of us are kind of masquerading.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Because when you get flowers from a florist, isn't it beautiful?
It's just better.
Way better.
It's just better.
But there's a price to be paid. You're paying a premium.
There is. But it's like plumbing. Like, you have an issue, you call the man.
Yeah.
If
you want to love somebody or impress somebody?
I think you
somebody.
Should call the man. I just think you should. Like, go to the person that knows how to do that.
So florist makes sense, but just don't order the squash.
No, I think you should order the squash. I think you should feel really good about the squash.
Do Kathy, I need to back up a little bit because you said something a little earlier in the show which really struck me. You said this, that it's good for me to not get what I want.
Mm-hmm. All the time.
All the
time.
We
were talking about giving up sugar for Lent, which is not a big sacrifice. But it's been a perpetual sacrifice. And it's been very hard.
Yes.
It's been very hard.
But it's good for me to not get what
I want.
That goes against
everything in our current culture and in my human nature.
Not in the current culture.
In every culture.
Since the beginning
of time. Yeah. So you asked me in the commercial break if there was a scripture passage that came to mind and thinking about that. And Galatians 5 came into my head thinking about the fruits of the Spirit. So it says the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness. Now, those are all you would expect those all.
Sure.
Self-control.
Bingo.
Self-control is the last one. Against such things, there is no law. Those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the sinful nature with its passions and desires. Since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. Let's not become conceited, provoking, and envying each other.
Mm-hmm. Against such thing, there is no law.
There is no law. I mean,
so I could eat those cookies.
Right. There just has to self-control, I think, as much as I hate it. And I'm so bad at it. It's just one of those things that as you progress in your maturity with Christ, it has to be part of the makeup. It has to be, as much as I hate it. I really hate it. I had a dream about dessert last night.
Right. Because you're struggling with self-control.
Yeah, it's hard. It's just out of something dumb like that.
It's good for me to not get what I want.
The Ride Home with John and Kathy, a production of Salem Media Group.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.